session number 13281, Reel 1.
Mr. Scroggy, Reel 1, whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in British Columbia in 1919, the son of a Scottish immigrant to these parts, who came from the area where I'm speaking now, the Dundee area.
Were you educated in Scotland or in British Columbia?
Not at all. I was only 3½, 4½ when the family came home. And I got all my education round about Dundee here, or in Edinburgh. My father having died, my mother managed to get myself and my twin brother into an institution for fatherless children in Edinburgh, where the two of us had a stupendously good education and a stupendously good time for 5 years. John Watson's Institution.
How old were you when you finished your education?
16. I managed to squeeze a bare higher leaving certificate and got a job with the local publishers in Dundee, D.C. Thompson, and I worked on the Boys Papers, Hotspur, Wizard, Skipper, Rover, and so forth until the outbreak of the war. That would be over a period of about 4 years.
You were telling me that before the war you did some mountaineering?
Yes, we certainly did. We were the proletariat took to the hills before the war, and myself and my pals worked away on the Angus Glens, notably Glen Clover, pioneering rock climbing there, and also to a certain extent in the Cairngorms. We loved living rough. We'd had such a Spartan education in Edinburgh from the athletics and physical point of view that I was always a chap who liked that kind of thing.
Because this is obviously irrelevant to what happened to you in the war.
Oh, yes, because I had the good fortune to finish up during the war in a division, the 52 Lowland Division, which for a period went in for mountain warfare. We were never quite certain whether we were designed to go into action as a mountain division, or the whole thing was a ruse to lead the Germans in Norway to believe that we were going to attack Norway. And we also had Norwegians stationed with us and officering with us, which lent colour to that. So I don't know the answer to that one. You'd have to check up with the Imperial War Museum.
What was your reaction in September 39 when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
Absolutely thrilled. We'd been expecting the war, of course, for at least a year, and myself and my chums in the Glens used to think, now, if the Germans invade Britain, as they've invaded Czechoslovakia, etc., what are we going to do? We would take to the hills and form some kind of local Alpini and attack them. All this was in the realms of fantasy rather than fact, but that was the situation.
So were you not dismayed in any way?
Dismayed? No. Pericles pointed out a long time ago that one of the snags about warfare is that the young don't realise what a rotten thing war is, so they're always spoiling for a fight when there's one around. And almost all of us, being young and being in jobs, which you half liked and half didn't, conceived of warfare as a romantic means of getting away from the humdrum everyday affairs of life. No, we were delighted when the war broke out. One of the most thrilling moments in my life was on the morning of the 1st of September, when I looked out the window of the courier office in Meadowside, Dundee, and saw a newsboy moving along the pavement opposite with the banner headline, "Germany Moves," which indicated that that morning the Germans had rushed into Poland. I thought, this is great. Well,
did you have any particular political attitude towards the German regime?
I was never very politically aware. I still am not to this day. I know fellows who actually joined the army on grounds of principle in order to fight fascism. But although I knew about the Spanish Civil War and all that kind of thing, I wasn't really alive enough to what was going on. No, no. The war was just a great big mixture general adventure, and that was going to be great. Well, and the object of the exercise would be to keep Hitler out of the British Isles if we could manage to do so.
So what steps did you take to get into the war yourself?
Well, as soon as the war declared, I went across to the university recruiting centre, and they were recruiting for potential officers. Well, if you had a higher leaving certificate and had a half-decent education, you could start in the army as a potential officer, so they put me down for that. And then I had to wait to be called up. And I filled up that wait by joining the local defense volunteers. And we manned strategic points in Dundee, railway junctions and telephone exchanges at night and so forth. We were armed with rather antiquated P-14 rifles, which had come in from the United States, or Ross rifles. And it was rather good fun, because there was a mixture of the young laddies like myself and the old greybeards from the First World War who could tell us their stories. And then on the 15th of August 1940, I believe there was a colossal intake into the British Army, because by that time they'd got enough uniforms and got enough equipment and so forth to accommodate this. So I marched into the barrack gates at Almada Street in Hamilton as a young soldier with the Cameronians on that date. So that was my start with the official army.
Before we go on to the Cameronians, can you tell me more about the Home Guard?
Well, it was not called the Home Guard. You see, I belong to the... I'm a basic man. I was an LDV man, not a Home Guard man. It hadn't come to be called the Home Guard when I was in it. It was simply the LDV. There were two companies, at least, I suppose, in Dundee, and I belong to the West End Company. And when I've said that it involved... It didn't involve, so far as I can remember, parades or anything of that description. Nobody ever taught me how to shoot a rifle or anything of that kind. No, no, we were just issued with a rifle and 10 rounds, and there was a roster whereby you went either to this place or that place when your turn came up and spent the night there, just in case the Germans dropped parachute troops or I suppose if there was some emergency where the air raid wardens and people like that might need to stiffen up a little bit.
You say your company was called West End.
Yes.
What was the other one?
My guess is the East End, the ancient division of Dundee into the East End and the West End. West End, the posh area. East End, the not so posh area.
When you say a company, do you mean...
About
like
120, I would imagine, yes. The old sweats in the LDV or the Home Guard would think in terms of much more people in a company. They were much bigger in those days. But I think they got themselves boiled down to the modern about three platoons of about 30 blokes each in a platoon headquarters, something like 120 strong in a company.
Do you remember any of the other personalities in it? Or the
yes, the commanding officer was actually called Hughie Carleton. A very small, brisk, officious Dundee solicitor who had a bit of army experience in the First World War, but not in the front. He never heard, as the saying goes, heard a shot fired in anger. He was, I don't say he was exactly like the officious company commander in Dad's army, but he was getting on for it, mannering. But he was a popular guy.
Any of the other people in it you remember?
There was a stockbroker, there was an old solicitor, there was a grocer. I don't remember their names, but they were all, they'd all been, as it were, blooded in the First World War. I don't remember any other chaps of my own age, which was 19.
Was there anything about it of the farcical character that's depicted in Dad's Army?
I would like to think there had been somewhere, but there wasn't so any place where I was around, no. But I'm a great fan of Dad's Army. I think it's absolutely a gorgeous one. And I'm sure it does reflect an aspect of the Home Guard as it gradually became. And, of course, the longer the war went on, the less likelihood there was that there was to be a German invasion. Perhaps things were slightly more serious early in the war, when there was a possibility, wasn't there? Later on, no, the chance of a German invasion receded and receded and receded, so that the Home Guard became more and more ornamental and less useful as time went on.
Did you learn much in a soldierly sense from the LDV?
I would say not. I would say not. There was a certain chap called Fenton, later Lord Provost of Dundee, who gave a command which is in the immortal class once. They were at firing practice at Barn Buddy Range, apparently, and he gave the command, one round, or rapid fire. And that's all I remember, really, about the LDV or the Home Guard.
Do you think it would have done a job if the
Germans
had
it? Oh, I'm perfectly certain they would have been effective in delaying, oh yes, locally, German advances and all the rest of it. I don't think there's ever been anything on this country like the scale of the invasion on our part of Northern Europe. No. I think they'd have been swept aside fairly readily by the more sophisticated weaponry and know-how of the German soldier. The German soldier who has been described to me not terribly long ago by a pal of mine who actually fought with the Cameroonians in Northern Europe in the latter part of the war. He referred to the German soldiers as craftsmen. And they were very, very dangerous opponents. They were very good soldiers. In most respects, they were better soldiers than we were.
What equipment did you say you had in the LDV?
I seem to remember that my uniform consisted of a sports jacket and a pair of flannel trousers. I think we had a distinctive forage cap headgear. And then, of course, we would be issued with our Ross or P-14 rifle when it came to a spot of duty overnight. But I don't think there was anything else in the way of equipment, not when I was in it. Of course, uniforms and boots and all kinds of second-hand army equipment came into the Home Guard later on, but that was after I had parted company with it and was in the real army, in the Almada barracks with the Cameroonians. And I absolutely loved my basic training in the army. 3 months judging distance and arms drill and squad drill and shooting, minor tactics and all the rest of it. I thought it was absolutely glorious. I loved square bashing. It was splendid. It was splendid actually to find yourself in a position where you were totally and utterly under authority and had to do what you were told. I think I tend to be the kind of guy who rather does well if somebody is telling me what to do. Somebody that I can recognize as somebody better at that kind of thing than I could ever be myself. I respond to that enormously. To be under a poor commander is a dreadful experience, because a poor commander can never bring out your potential. I had the experience subsequently in the army as a junior officer, mostly, of having very indifferent company commanders and battalion commanders, and I never flourished under these people at all, because they did not have the divine gift of leadership, that is, of bringing out the very best in their subordinates. Occasionally, I encountered people on courses, notably at the GHQ Battle School Barnard Castle, where the staff were all in the leadership class par excellence. And the boss was a London stockbroker in Civvy Street, Colonel Wigram. And by Jove, what a splendid book that was. And everybody who was there going through the course felt invigorated and vitalized and realized in themselves, from the tactical point of view and the fighting point of view, a potential he might never have discovered otherwise. However, we're at Almada Barracks. Well,
what is the secret of getting the best out of your subordinates in the army?
Well, I suppose by your personal mastery of the subject and a rather indefinable personality factor, you get the people under you wanting to be told what to do by this particular person, in the conviction that to do what that person wants them to do is the best possible thing that can be done, given the particular context. That must be an aspect of it. Xenophon said a long time ago, soldiers must be more afraid of their commanders than they are of the enemy. But I think it's far, far better to be more in love with your commanders than afraid of them, in the last analysis. And I did have this experience of having the utmost veneration for the odd character who was over me at one time or another during the war. It was the same when I went to university. After the war, I had a tutor, a Scotsman, I'm glad to say, and he had the capacity of making me a far better thinking machine than I could possibly have been left to my own devices. That was another form of leadership, but it was analogous to the kind of army leadership we're trying to analyze.
You were going to go on. I interrupted you about Al Mardabat.
Yes, after the 3 months, those who hadn't got it in them to be put to be officers were weeded out. And then a brigadier came along, and I got interviewed to see if I was a fit material to go to the 165 Infantry Officer Cadet Training Unit, Dunbar. Well, that was all right. I knew the answer to all the questions, etc., etc. And I had written previously an essay which had been rather highly commended based on a book called The Officer and Fighting Efficiency. Now the brigadier would test me on my knowledge of contemporary affairs. So he asked me a question which I was only able to answer because I happened to be to the toilet before I went there, and there were some newspapers strung up there. And the newspaper contained a leading article from the Daily Express, which entirely answered the question the brigadier asked by quoting that. I think by quoting that alone, I was passed for entry into the 165 Officer Cadet Training Unit, Dunbar.
What did you think to the course there?
Not much. I mean, nobody did. It was still early in the war, and we were still being trained in 1914 to 1918 infantry tactics. I was 4 months at the cadet unit in Dunbar, and I never heard the word tank and never heard the word dive bomber. And these were the two things that were going to decide the war in the early stages. No, we were busy digging trench systems and erecting barbed wire entanglements. It was all quite useless. It was only later on when the army took a notion to itself, and a certain book was brought out, written by a General Kelso, called The Little Red Book, which devised totally and utterly different infantry drills. You see, Marlborough only won the battles of Blenheim and Malplaquet, Oudenarde, etc., because he devised a new infantry drill. Robert Bruce only beat the English at Bannockburn because he devised a new infantry drill, which is unfamiliar to the foe. It was the same in the Second World War. We started off 1914 to 1918 mentality. We went on, under the genius of this General Kelso, entirely to change our attitude towards minor infantry tactics and what you did with your weapons and so forth. And he brought it out in his little red book, and this was the basis of the so-called battle schools, which came to be established, the GHQ battle school. And they trained officers and sergeants, and they went to the back to their divisions, and divisional battle schools were set up. And it utterly transformed the morale of the army. Now, most of the army, most of the time, wasn't in the desert, wasn't in Southeast Asia. Most of the army was in Great Britain, waiting for the second front. And a problem, of course, with an army which is sitting around is one of morale. And I would say that these battle schools utterly transformed the morale of the British Army at home, which was getting very sluggish and couldn't care lessish. And the boys started to get interested in fighting because realism came into it. You were attacked by real tanks. You were fired at by real bullets. You were mortar bombed by real mortars. It was fun and it was real. And the idea was to subject the boys to conditions the likes of which they were never likely to experience at that intensity in actual warfare. So when we did go abroad, what most of us experienced was never as hard and never, I won't say never as dangerous, but never as obviously dangerous as it was in the battle schools. They were brilliant, weren't they? So when I emerged from with a pip on my shoulders from Dunbar, I was posted to the Cameronians, the same regiment I'd done my basic training with, and found myself attached to the 7th Cameronians, 156th Brigade, 52nd Lowland Division, at that time stationed in Bridgevallen, which is near Stirling in the lowlands of Scotland. My most dramatic memory of that was on the 17th of March 1941, the night of the Clydebank raid, and all the German bombers were coming over Bridgevallen, droves and droves of them, and the spectacle to the west Well, I can only compare it with one of the great sights I've seen in my life, which was the great aurora of 1937. The whole of the western sky was ablaze with lights, bomb flashes, chandelier flares coming down, the red pinpricks of AK-AK shells going off, the searchlights combing about. I was unaware that 32,000 houses were being rendered unfit for human habitation after that, and God knows how many people were being killed. But what a spectacle it was. It was only to be compared with the spectacle which I observed 3 years later in Italy, when the 8th Army were crossing the Senio, and myself and my then regiment, the Lovett Scouts, were on top of the Gesso Ridge, looking down the River Senio, the Germans on the left bank, the 8th Army on the right bank, and the day before the assault, waves of bombers came over, liberators, to the number of 500 in batches of 10 or 20, dropping the bombs on the Germans from a fairly high altitude. And then another 500 Mitchells and Hudsons, smaller bombers, bombing the Germans from a lower level. And on a lower level, still Spitfires, Hurricanes, Typhoons and Whirlwinds, cannoning them and machine gunning them from a lower level still. And the glorious April day of heat and sunshine, and the cuckoos calling, a colossal cloud of brown dust rising thousands of feet in the air. What a spectacle it was. I mean, it was pretty costly as regards the taxpayers' money. And I believe that hardly any Germans got killed. But they were also stunned and rendered bomb happy by the sheer noise and concussion that they were very easily swept aside when the 8th Army crossed the Senio at dawn next day.
But when you saw this raid of the 17th of March 1941 in Glasgow,
yes,
apart from the spectacle which it afforded from the viewpoint of the Bridge of Allen, were you also dismayed that
no.
the Germans were causing so much damage?
Not in the least. We expected that kind of thing. Well, I don't think you worry too much about philosophical matters of that kind when you're 20 or 21 and so forth. It was just a glorious display. And we were vaguely aware that if the Germans were dropping bombs on us now, the likelihood was, as we gradually got stronger and stronger, and, as was almost inevitable, the Americans joined in on our side eventually, and the Germans would be paid back for all the damage that they'd done and the deaths they'd caused over here. There's a very pathetic memorial on a hill called Cairnsmore of Fleet, above Gatehouse of Fleet in the southwest of Scotland. Margaret and I climbed it a year or two ago. It is a beautiful monument in marble to the crew of a German bomber coming back from the Clydebank raid, which had run out of steam and crashed on the mountain. Slightly pathetic, you know, one. They were just kids of 17, 18 and 19 in that bomber. And they had been dropping their bombs on Clydebank. I said to Margaret, well, I don't know, it must have been the Germans who erected this memorial. I doubt if they got any money out of the people of Clydebank to put it up. But it was slightly pathetic.
But did you ever think the Germans were going to win the war?
Never for a minute. The great mood in 1940, when the Germans swept into France and polished France off and chased the British Army and all the rest of it back over the Channel, you know, the great feeling that swept through the British was just one of relief. They thought, my God, thank heavens, we're finished with all these damned foreign entanglements. We'll never beat the Germans so long as we're allied to these inferior people, the French. That was the feeling. Whether that feeling was subtly induced by some kind of propaganda we were unaware of, I don't know. But then there were two great things all the way through the war. One, I think, on a Thursday evening with Tommy Hanley and Itmar. The other was Winston Churchill, who gave an occasional speech after the 9 o'clock news on the Home Service. And some of the greatest things you could ever have heard in this life were those speeches of Churchill relating to the situation during the war. He seemed to time them for moments when he thought perhaps the national morale needed a bit of a boost. And there was never anybody in human history better calculated to give morale a boost than Winston Churchill.
Why should Itmar have had such a good effect?
I think because it removed you from the realms of the real to the realms of the fantasy. And it had this great attribute. All great works of art appeal not only to the intelligentsia, but also to Tom, Dick and Harry. That's true of the works of Shakespeare. In their day, the intelligentsia understood what they were all about. The groundlings enjoyed them just for the story and for the buffoonery and the characters and the drama. It's the same with Itmar. It had this divine quality X, where on the one hand, university professors and bishops of the Church of England were tuning into it every Thursday evening. And at the other end of the scale, Joe Soap and his wife were listening to it, and they all got the most colossal and wonderful enjoyment out of Itmar. It was one of the greatest things to preserve morale in this country during the war, I'm perfectly sure.
Now, there you are with the 7th Battalion
right
at the Bridge of Allen. Can you take the story a bit further? Is it concerned?
Well, we moved to various other localities, Crieff, and then to Aberdeen. And it was about this time we began to get Norwegian, an influx of Norwegian officers. And then in no time we were under canvas on Speyside, around about Abbey Moor, Loch Alvey, Loch Patulish, engaged in mountain warfare training. And this is where the general feeling was, well, we don't really think we're going to fight in the mountains anywhere, but maybe this is just a ruse to deceive the Germans into thinking that Britain are going to attack on the right wing of Hitler's Europe in Norway. Mind you, we'd been chased out of Norway earlier on, hadn't we? But we hadn't got any equipment, and we hadn't got the manpower, and we hadn't got the air power to do anything about it in those days. It was a silly venture, really. However, there we were, and the interesting was that in those early days of the mountain warfare training, we had quite a lot of Indian troops for this, from the Indian subcontinent. It had not been divided, of course, into Bangladesh, Pakistan and India by that time. It was just India, all India. And there were Indians handled our transport, and there were Indian lancers there. Mounted lancers, and it was quite possible in the Rothiemurchus forest amongst the ancient pine trees of Scotland, which had been there from time immemorial since after the glacier, to come across a troop of these dark-skinned, turbaned lancers jingling along on their horses. It was really all rather romantic. Meantime, we were doing exercises in the hills. Now, I knew something about the hills, and being something of a mountaineer and a rock climber. The last thing the army wanted was information from people who knew about these things. That is to say, I would be the one chap, junior officer in the whole battalion, that knew something about the mountains. You were never consulted. But wasn't it true that as soon as the army discovered that you wanted to do one thing, they would make you do the very reverse of it? I think that's a very common shaft delivered at the army mentality as a rule. So I was never consulted. They never said, Scroggy, what do you think? You've done a bit of climbing. What do you think we ought to do? No, no. They carried on in the good old Sandhurst manner. What?
What about the traditions of the Cameronians?
The Cameronians are a splendid old Scottish regiment going right the way back to about the time of Killiecrankie. Uh-huh. In fact, they favoured the Williamites rather than the Jacobites at Killiecrankie. Huh? And they when the troops of General Mackay were swept